You're listening to Face Off, episode 68, recorded May 10th, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
Coming in via Skype this week is me, Mark Sanborn.
In this podcast, talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, well, we have a interesting turn of events this week. We found out that our very own Mark Sanborn, who was an adamant anti-Apple, anti-Macintosh OS X person, has just bought a MacBook Pro.
I have sold my soul to Steve Jobs and Apple Corporation.
He gobbled it up with zero hesitation. So what do you think? I mean, you know, you've been a guy, you come over to my house, we record the show on an iMac. You know, you've played around with it a little bit, and you kind of really just took the plunge head first. What do you think?
Yeah, so I've been a Windows guy for forever, and then I was a Windows guy forever, and then I moved on to Linux as my main kind of development box, and I fell in love with the terminal and got into all that good stuff, and I kind of needed I didn't need a laptop, but I don't know, I got like three computers already. What's another one, you know? I just added to I don't know. You kind of convinced me that the Macs had I was kind of in the market for a laptop, and I've been kind of eyeballing OS X as an operating system just to try out and see what it's all about. And you said that Mac laptops had good hardware, you know, it's like all a unified one solid metal body.
Right. And
so I took the plunge and got a MacBook, kind of an impulse buy, and I like it. Like, one of the things that I really like is Rails and like Python. Everything that I needed to develop, it's got Bash, is all kind of installed automatically.
Yeah, that is nice. Ruby 187. So, that's funny. I've been in the market for a laptop. I think I'd like to buy another one because we both had netbooks. We have 10-inch netbooks, and I have found that 10-inch is just is too small. I like a 12 or 13-inch laptop, I've decided. I had my old Toshiba M200, which is a 13-inch laptop, and I've always liked that size. And so now that, you know, I've had a bunch of coworkers who got the new 13-inch MacBook Pro, and it is a magnificent piece of hardware. It really is. And I thought, oh, if I buy one, I'll buy one and put Linux on it. But it really is great hardware.
Yeah, like the power cable is basically a magnet. So if you trip over, someone just plops out. You can flip the power cable. You can have that, like, basically the cable running from the back of the Mac out. Like, you can switch the direction. You can have the wire coming towards you.
Right. Because the old
it's got multi-touch where you could just take two fingers and scroll down. And you know, like most. I mean, I've never had a laptop that had multi-touch, like touchpad.
Yeah. So what did you? I mean, what convinced you? Did you just decide you needed a bigger laptop too? Because your first laptop was the netbook that you bought, and you seemed pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I've done maybe, you know, extended hours of programming on it, a couple of hours here and there. I feel like the netbook is just like a very, very temporary, if I have to, development. It works. I can do things, but the screen's kind of small. I can't see a whole lot of code. And with the with a MacBook, the 12 or what is it, 13 inches?
Yeah, 13 inches.
I think it is. Yeah. It's a world of a difference. Like, I could definitely see myself if I had, I mean, I would have to bring like a little mouse along with me, but I could develop on that.
Right. Yeah. If you were stuck, like, in an airport for 3 hours, you know, you wouldn't feel bad about programming on it at all. It wouldn't bug you or anything.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to probably use that trackpad all day long doing programming, but then again, with programming,
you should be using it anyways, Mark. What's wrong with you, huh? Come on.
Yeah, I should be using the keyboard more. Well, I do actually. I use the keyboard a lot, but yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. The only some annoyances that I had were the command versus control and alt and option.
Yeah, those
kind of like getting used to the shortcuts in different places. Because I am a keyboard, I do use the keyboard a lot, and so.
So this weekend, we record the show on an iMac. I have an aluminum iMac. Love it, great piece of hardware. So this weekend, I decided to try and install Ubuntu on it. So, man, I'm I had a lot of trouble with it because I'm kind of an idiot. It wasn't anything. I was just kind of doing some stupid stuff. But I finally got it to dual boot between OS X and Ubuntu. And I got to tell you, the new version of Ubuntu on this iMac, it really fits. Like, I've noticed that it just seems a lot like I didn't even really notice that I was in a new operating system. I would sit down, and I knew that I was at my iMac, so I went into sort of Mac mode. I was trying all of my Mac hot shortcut keys in Ubuntu, you know, because it just the new version really is smooth. They did some things like they moved the close and minimize and maximize buttons to the left side of the screen, which is just like on the Mac, whereas the normal like Windows and sort of GNOME defaults have it on the right. It's really polished, really clean. The OS looks great. They kind of got away some of the things that were sort of classic Ubuntu, like the human theme with the orange and the brown. They kind of got away from that. It's this dark, darker color. Definitely looks a lot more like OS X. And I'm really, really impressed with it. And I thought it was kind of funny that I kind of hopped onto it. It was Ubuntu. It was, you know, Linux, which I know, but I immediately just hopped into my OS X keyboard shortcuts and was getting upset at myself because I was hitting, you know, Command L instead of Control D to get to the address bar.
Yeah, it's definitely a good change. I like to see it. It's definitely probably my favorite, the best looking Ubuntu thus far.
Yeah,
I definitely think it's an improvement that way. They're like the tooltips are transparent, like black. Well, actually, what theme did it come with? Because I've had mine installed for a little while, and I have like the darker theme. Is it the lighter one?
No, it's definitely the darker theme. It's the darker theme with the buttons on the left hand side.
It's like a dark kind of gray,
right? And the it has sort of the very sort of OS X-ish status bar in the upper right hand, where everything sort of looks like these monochrome icons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting. I was really glad because I've been an Ubuntu user for a long time. Debian is definitely my flavor of Linux, and I was glad to see this new version. It looks great on this iMac, and I finally got to dual boot, so dual boots really cleanly and easily, boots right into Linux, and I have a little more options now if I want to. The reason I got an iMac for recording the podcast was because I wanted something that was powerful and big but wasn't a full computer. So this, you know, the all-in-oneness of the iMac made it nice. So now, actually, you never know, if I go over to someone's house to program, I might just tag this along instead of my laptop because I got Ubuntu on and it's got a nice big old monitor on it, you know?
Yeah.
You know how that goes. All right, so Mark sold his soul to Steve Jobs and got a Mac. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. Our geek tool this week was, I decided to put it on the show because I have been having some interesting hardware issues with my Xbox 360. For a while there, my drive would just kind of stop working, and it seemed like the only way I could ever play a video game was to have Mark come over and work his magic touch on it. I wasn't sure how that worked. You would spend 15 minutes, and all of a sudden my drive would work for like 2 days, and then it would stop again. Very frustrating. So, but to tear apart my Xbox 360, I had to have Torx screws, specifically some really small Torx screws. And it made me kind of realize the importance of having a good screwdriver set. You know, it's important to have good screwdrivers. And while I think most of the time, if you can, try and use a regular screwdriver, our Geek Tool of the Week is a KR Tools Auto Loader 6-in-1 Auto Loading Screwdriver with a 52-piece set. The auto loader is you can load sort of 6 bits into the handle, and you just kind of pull and twist and then push, and it'll auto load whatever bit, you know, you rotate it to, so that you don't have to fumble with your bits falling around or losing
it. It's like the old screwdriver revolver.
Yeah, it kind of it is. It's kind of a mix between a revolver and a shotgun, because you kind of have to like, you're kind of pumping it like a shotgun to pull it apart to turn it, but it's got 6 bits in it, and you know,
you load them up like little bullets.
You load them up like little bullets. The reason I specifically posted this one was because it comes with a regular size sort of screwdriver that takes big bits, and then it has also the precision screwdriver. It comes with all sorts of different sizes, specifically the smaller Torx head bits, which was what I needed. You know, most drivers come with like one or two Torx heads, like T10 and T15, and I needed like T7 and T8, I think. So I had to go buy a new set. But this one comes with all the smaller ones. It comes with the precision auto loading screwdriver, so you should be able to open up anything. It comes with a cool little magnetic flashlight too, so you can, you know, it's got a little 3-LED light that you can stick on something metal and turn it on. It'll give you light wherever you need it. And you know, we've been big fans of lighting up your workspace in the past 3 episodes.
Yeah.
With all our flashlight talk. So check it out. Get the link to it in the show notes. It is the KR Tools Auto Loading 6-in-1 Screwdriver 52 V-Set Blue.
All right, so we got web apps today. We got PicGhost. What is PicGhost?
All right, PicGhost is our first web app. PicGhost is a really cool site that lets you do mass editing of images. So a lot of times, you know, if you have to do sort of mass editing, you can set up like what do you call them, macros in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. If you have Photoshop, which a lot of us don't because it's really expensive. I'm not sure about the GIMP. When I usually have to do resizing or anything like that, I tend to use an application called Irfan View, which is made by some guy named Irfan who does really good batch processing for like resizing or for compression. But if you don't want to do or the other way is to sort of get into the terminal and you know, whip up Image Magic on the command line and try and do a bunch of your modifications that way, doesn't suit a lot of people. That's kind of, you know, a lot of those solutions are maybe out of some people's skill range or whatever. So check out PicGhost. You can upload up to 20 images. You can do all kinds of little tweaks like applying a watermark, resizing. And when you're done, it, you know, lets you download all of your images in a nice zip file so you don't have to download them all individually or anything like that. And that is at PicGhost.com.
I like it.
You like it because you're the image magic guy, right? You like to get in the command line.
I do, but you know, to be honest, it's only for like simple resizing because that's the command. Like I can memorize that one. It's simple. It's like hyphen resize space the height or width. But like if I want to do a simple watermark, I mean it'd probably take me 20 minutes to go read the man page right. And go find a picture that I want overlaid on top and make sure the opacity's right. And you know, this is way easier for simple operations. You know, if I was gonna add watermarking to my like Ruby Rails like web page or something, you know, maybe I would do Image Magic and get that going. But
right, because you need it for an app. This is not for programmatic image editing. This is for you're a dude and you've got, you know, a lot of images that you need to do something to.
Yeah, but if I had like 20 product images and I needed to make thumbnails real quick or something, maybe I'd just upload them to here. Yeah. You know, way I go.
Yeah, check it out, picghost.com. All right, our next web app, really simple little kind of one. It's called ipadpeak.com, and all this sort of does is gives you a screen that looks like an iPad. You put in your web address, and it sort of previews what your website would look like on an iPad. So, disclaimer, it basically sort of shows you what it would look like with the correct width. It doesn't really do any of the special... what would you call it? Like special Safari rendering or anything like that you can if you have like a website specifically for.
So it probably still renders Flash even though iPad have Flash.
Yeah. True. So it will, but it, you know, it's more of a kind of like, what would my site look like on an iPad, you know, and it'll do that for you.
The handy thing about this is it gives you the resolution that an iPad owner would see your site in.
Right.
So
not like, oh, actually, it doesn't render Flash. It does stop Flash from rendering for you. Interesting. So at least it'll show you that, right?
Jeez.
That's funny. You know, the funny thing I was trying to do is with this app is I kept pushing like the little menu button at the bottom or like the battery button to see if, you know, there's like some Easter eggs in here or if I could actually. Because if you do type in the keyboard spot, it does pull up a keyboard.
Click the border.
Border like the black,
like the silver gray border. It flipped mine. I'm in portrait mode now.
Oh, at the top. Okay, yeah. So you can flip it and see in portrait landscape. Yeah, okay. So that's how you did it. I could have swore I read that you could do that in the application, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. So yeah, if you click the little silver border at the top, it'll flip it for you, so you can see it in portrait or landscape, whatever you want. It doesn't render Flash, but it also doesn't render the fancy Safari page. So if you went through and when, you know, the iPad and iPhone Touch and the iPod Touch and the iPhone were first released and you went through and made a special page for those, you know, it won't render those specially, but it'll show you, you know, a regular website kind of what it would look like in an iPad by going to ipadpeak.com. All right. So before we move on, though, I do want to remind you guys, if you have some news, a follow-up, or web application you want us to take a look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Any of the ways that we get feedback, we try and listen to you guys, do what you want, because we like to give you content that you enjoy. So go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know.
All right, this week's topic is caching.
All right, so talking money, right? Give me some cash, Mark.
Yeah, so speaking of...
Not that kind of cash.
Not that kind of cash. What is caching? It's basically you're either redirecting or changing the response to a request to be more efficient. One of the goals is to reduce latency. We want things now. We want a page to come up faster than it would otherwise. The other reason, if you've got Amazon S3 or CloudFront or something, and you're paying by the CPU cycle or by the, gigabit or whatever in network traffic, you want to reduce the load of your servers or also the bandwidth. You don't want to be transferring huge files if you don't have to. So those are the two main reasons for caching. So with those two, there's two kind of major groups of caching. There's like the web client side, what the browser does for the user on behalf of the user. Mm-hmm. And then there's server side caching. So with the client side caching, most of the stuff is kind of done. You don't really have to do anything. The browser does it by itself. For example, like CSS, when you load up a web page, it downloads the CSS, and then it keeps that CSS for the remainder of your visit to that site. So you can just click around, and it doesn't have to re-download that page every time.
So like a good example, if I can interrupt you real quick, is how Google started storing a lot of really popular JavaScript frameworks on their servers. And they and a lot of users like us were highly encouraged to do that, because let's say if any user goes to any website that has that JavaScript framework on Google's, it's cached. Google has it set to cache for a long time because it doesn't change. It's the same version forever. So when they go to my page and I'm pointing to the same jQuery file on Google that they had used on some other website, that's okay because it's already cached and it saves me bandwidth.
Yeah, exactly. The user no longer has to download that jQuery. They've already got it. So it's like it never even existed. But if they didn't have it and they went to their site, you'd still be able to see it. So with the client side, so if it's on the client side and the web browser's kind of doing it, what can you kind of control? What can you do on the web side of it, the web developer side of it? Well, there's in the HTTP headers, there's a few variables that you can change. Some of them are changed for you, like the last modified. Sometimes the web browser will check to see if like an image has changed. If it hasn't changed, then it just keeps the one that it already had loaded, for example. If it detected that the image is no longer the same image, maybe it's a different file size or the hash is different or whatever. Well, in this case, it's the last modified. It would say, "Oh, okay, then give me that image."
Right.
The next one that's set is the expires header. You can say, keep this CSS file around for 2 days, because by default the browser might be set to store the CSS file for that session until the browser's closed. It might store it for an hour. Right. It's hard to say unless you specifically set it as the web developer, and that's what the expires header is for. And then there's kind of fine-grained control with the header called cache control. And in that, there's a few variables, like one that you can set is no cache, which forces the web browser to validate the resource before each time. So if you have normally if the browser just goes and says, "Oh, it's a CSS file, I'm going to keep this for the remainder of the session," or whatever, with no cache, you can say, "Well, you better check my other variables that I'm going to have set here too, like my max age," which we're going to talk about all these, but the max age or the E tags. So the next one is the no store, which basically says under no circumstances do any caching. So this was kind of weird. It was like, I thought no cache would do this, but it's no store. So
yeah.
this one's like, if you have a page that has private data or sensitive stuff or live data that you don't want somebody accidentally getting an old cache version or something, maybe you're relying on this data to be fresh, you would use the no store variable there.
Okay.
The next one is kind of weird. It's called no transform. And this is one of those things that when you're going through the HTTP spec, you're like, really, what is it? I mean, I've never heard of this no transform thing.
Yeah, totally. I've never ever heard of this at all.
Basically, what it does is it disables the client's, so the browser's ability to do any monkeying around with the file or the resource that's coming through. To give an example, Opera Mobile, I think it was, used to, or it might still do this, it had the ability to take it like a JPEG or whatever and then run it through its own compression algorithm to make it even smaller.
Right.
And then offer that file up.
Right. So it, no used transform- like a, it used like a transforming proxy, which we also have to remember, not only are browsers part of this spec, but also any client using, you know, sort of HTTP is. So this includes like proxies, right? So if you went through Opera Mobile, who went through a proxy that compressed everything for you to make it faster for your mobile device, you know, it would say, hey, listen, I know you know, you may be one of those things that transforms images to compress them and stuff, but this one, do not mess with this. Because like one example is like medical images, right?
Yeah, the example they gave in the HTTP spec is certain medical images, they can't be altered or they can't be used or whatever the case may be. So the no transform is just there to say it basically says this, I don't care if you can compress this further, don't do it because I don't want it getting messed with.
Yeah.
The next one, must revalidate. It basically, this is a tag to tell the client or the browser or the proxy or whatever. Like you said, any client can, anything that understands HTTP requests can do these things. But must revalidate basically says, you have to follow my rules that I set. Don't go by your own. Use these rules. So, because you have to remember that the browsers don't, I mean, if you don't set some of these things, it can assume. It can say, well, I don't know, I'll do this for an hour or something. Because it's kind of like a browser's seeing like markup errors or something and doing their own thing, try to like recover from it.
Like,
you know,
Firefox, sometimes with Firefox, it's such a pain. Like, you'll be refreshing. If you develop with Firefox, you learn eventually to do Control Shift R instead of F5. Mm-hmm. Because F5 does a refresh, and Firefox sort of has its own caching rules. Like, sometimes it just decides to cache stuff for you. We don't really understand why, but we know that if we do Control Shift R, that's like a hard refresh, and it actually sort of ditches its own caching rules. Whereas Chrome, I found when you do a refresh with Chrome, it must always just follow the server's rules no matter what. I think it kind of is a little more strict about it because Google seems to be a company that would do something like that. Where no matter what, if you refresh in Chrome, it's always like a hard refresh in Firefox. It never does sort of its own caching rules.
Yeah. The next one is max age. This one basically just how long is the resource considered fresh. This overrides the expires header, so it's basically another way to just say this thing expires at this time.
Right.
And then there's another one that was interesting, cache extension. The way I read it, I hope I'm interpreting it right because it was kind of confusing, but the cache extension, it appeared to be a way for you to write your own rules and your own. So this would be like you would write it for your server and the client, and you would talk to yourself about, you know, so. I mean, you
could set up stuff or something.
Yeah, you could set up your own tag that says if this is coming from this, they gave an example of branches of offices, and if you're in this one, it did this certain other thing. It's kind of, I think, for private use to extend the cache headers.
Right. If you're doing the server and the client and you say, oh, I'm going to do this with the client, you can stick it there.
Yeah. I believe that's the purpose. I'm wrong, somebody correct me.
Yeah, I'm curious because I wonder if anybody out there that we know has used this, because I certainly have not.
The next one is the public variable, which if you're doing HTTP basic auth, the browsers assume that you don't want it cached because it's authenticated, but it could still be a public service that just happened to have a username and password for some reason, and you want to mark that as cacheable. So just by saying public, it marks authenticated requests as cacheable.
Okay, so we do have some. We talked about the last modified, the expires, and then these are the cache control headers. There is like a fourth header as well called etags, and so etags are used in caching. They're really different. They're really weird because the way they work is when the browser requests a page, it gets an etag. I assume that you have to implement etags. First of all, I don't know if they're optional or not, because there are other headers that you can base your cache on. But if you are using etags, what it is when a user requests a page, it gets an etag, which the etags are generated kind of however different servers implement it. It doesn't matter, because what it does is when it makes another request, it sends that e-tag. And if that e-tag is the same, then the browser sends it to 304, which means it has not changed and the cached version is still valid. If the e-tag is different, then it sends it to 200 and tells it to grab the new content. So, you know, it doesn't matter how e-tags are implemented because, well, it can actually. What I did find out is it does matter how you implement your e-tags because, like, for one example, I was looking at Joshua Shanter's blog, and he was talking about how they had a server that was doing load balancing, and the default Apache e-tag is generated from three things, one of which includes the last modified. So they were using source control to distribute their code to the different to their different servers. But he started noticing, like, why is my CSS is getting requested a lot more than it should? He's like, it should be cached a lot more. I noticed these requests. I mean, what he found out was when he was using source control to send out his new CSS file, it was, you know, one server was a second behind the other. So it had a different last modified, and that was included in the e-tag. So a user would do it, and it would send it to one server and say, oh, here's the e-tag using this last modified, right? It'd be like, here's the e-tag. And then next time they'd reload a page, and it would send them to the other server, and it'd be like, oh, no, your e-tag's different. You have to re-download the entire CSS file. And so what he found is there is a way in Apache to change what is included in the e-tag so that, you know, because it doesn't matter. As different servers can implement it different ways. It just, the e-tag just has to be different if the content of the file is actually different.
Mm-hmm.
So there is different ways to do it, and you have to be careful with it because, like you said, he found out that he was getting a lot more requests than he should have because last modified was included in the e-tag when it shouldn't be.
Yeah, so since we... So what can we do with these headers? So since we know we've got last modified and expires, and some of these things can affect the way browsers cache things, what we can do, for example, like what you shouldn't do is when you upload your site, if you change something that didn't actually change, you're changing the last modified date, and then the caches will re-download that unnecessarily.
Right.
So you want to be careful not to just, if you make one change to your CSS, don't upload your entire site again.
Right, because a lot of people, when they use FTP, I mean, I used to do this back in the day, you go into your local folder, control A to select them all, drag it over to your remote folder and let it take care of it. And I'm assuming most FTP programs, because they're just dumb, they just upload everything. You know, why not just upload it all? Who cares? Which changes the last modified, which means every time when people visit your site from now on, they're re-downloading all those files because they have a new last modified date.
So I was reading in the Yahoo Developer Center about – it was this whole article about scaling and how to make these high scalable sites. One of their strategies was to set a far future – we're talking like 1 year in advance – into the future expire header. So like a logo wouldn't expire for an entire year. And why would you do that? Well, right now – so if you don't have – if the browser is unsure that – it has a fresh copy, it will ask the server, it won't get the copy yet. It'll ask the server and say, hey, is this last modified? When was this last modified? Or is it okay that I show the cached version? Or do you have a newer version? It checks the e-tags, whatever it does, it has to validate it. If the browser has an expiration date of, let's say, 2 months, and it's like, you know, nowhere near that, the browser will just, it won't even ask the server. It'll just display that, what it has in the cache. And so this is good for a web developer. For the user, they're pulling this resource from their own hard drive. Right. It's like instantaneous. The problem, though, is this can be – well, actually, I should say, how do you refresh – what if you change the logo?
Right, exactly. Then you're like, oh, great, they have this cache for 2 years and you can't stop it. Or can you right? What's the strategy for that?
Yeah, you can't wait for a year before you change your logo if you need to make a change. So what you do is, since these expiration and are tied to a specific resource, if you change the file name, you're basically changing it. It's like a new resource. So if you change the file name to like style.thedate.css or something, that's a different file.
Yeah.
And so what they recommended is, like I said, to do a year in advance expiration header, but just whenever you needed to make a change, you change the file name. Right. The problem with this is it can be dangerous if you forget to do it or something. Someone will see a very, very stale version of the site or the logo. And it requires a lot of work. Right. It seems like the more advanced you get with the caching, the lot, you know, the more work you have to do to manage it.
Well, there's some, there's like some basic caching that almost seems to be sort of, you know, built in and inherently, you know, sort of dumb, but it works in sort of the basic HTTP spec. But then you can also really dig in if you are super concerned about, you know, like, these articles are always on something like Yahoo, who is, you know, super concerned where, you know, like for me on my blog, I'm just worried about people downloading large content all the time. Or if I do get a burst of traffic from like Dig, I want it to be a little bit smarter about how it handles it. But sites like Yahoo, requests are important. I mean, you know, if every single resource, if they don't cache and every single resource hits their servers every time with the, you know, millions of people that visit their website every day, there's trouble.
Yeah, so a strategy like this might not be worth it if you're, you know, just doing a local blog or local site. But it's interesting to know some of these techniques.
Totally.
And then there's, so that was kind of like the web side or the client side, the web browser side of caching. Most of it's done for you. There's a few things you can tweak, you know, with the e-tags like we talked about. But the other side of it is server-side caching. And these are things you can do. Well, the first thing you can do is let's say you've got a PHP blog or whatever, and when you write content, obviously you don't want to have to rewrite all the HTML every time you have a new article and change your homepage to say, oh, we got a new article. So we write blogs in PHP and have dynamic sites. But if you think about a blog, the only time it really changes is when you write a new article or you get a new comment, right?
Right, right.
So what they do there is they have PHP run and basically generate the HTML output of the blog articles and the homepage and things. And maybe let's say they refresh that once an hour or once a new article is published or a new comment comes through. Other than that, it gives the same content to every single person. Right. It doesn't have to regenerate every single time a new person comes there.
So we use like WP Supercache on our blogs. And what it does is when someone requests a page, if you know that page has not been statically generated yet, it generates a cache version of it and sends that instead. And it's really easy for it to do this because it's integrated with the blog platform. It only has to regenerate that cache, and it knows if you make a new post. It's not, you know, it's not dumb like the HTTP header. You know, it's part of the application. So it can say, oh, I know, you know, you made a new blog post, so this, you know, this one is not good anymore.
Right.
And so that's pretty handy.
Yeah, basically you eliminate, so for every person that comes to your site, you they don't have to do PHP. There's no MySQL lookups. There's none of that stuff. It's just a static HTML that gets displayed. And once an hour, it does the MySQL lookup and so on. So the other thing, it's a little bit more advanced, I guess, kind of on the line of the Yahoo thing, is data caching, where when you do it with Memcache, where basically you do a query to the database. You store that into the RAM, and then so you can access it for the next user that comes along and does that same query. Obviously, you know, big sites like Google, Facebook are doing this. When you do a search, it's almost instantaneous. The reason is because they're storing a lot of these queries.
Right.
They're not actually going out right that second and going and doing searches. It would take a lot longer than
just does the legwork once and keeps it in memory for the same stuff to happen over and over again.
A word of the wise when doing caching, if you can turn it off in development when you're doing development, because you'll go nuts trying to say, you know, I changed this. This should be changed or working or whatever. And it's not, it's because it's cached. I've ran into that many times when doing WordPress stuff and forget that the caching is turned on. Some cool tools to use is Redbot. And that's at redbot.org. You just type in your URL and it'll go and fetch all your resources and show you what the headers are for each one and what things you can improve. It's kind of like YSlow, but basically a web app. And then there's YSlow, and then Google also has one. They're basically just browser extensions or plugins that you add, and it does the same thing. It just shows you your resources and how much time is spent downloading certain things.
Yeah, so a lot of people use YSlow because they want to minimize their YSlow score as much as possible. It's kind of a good metric for how optimized and fast your stuff is. But it definitely can get a little intense in what it wants you to do sometimes, and I would recommend that you really check it out before you just do everything they say blindly.
So there's your basic intro to caching, and that's about it.
All right, money, money. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to remind you guys you can subscribe to the show by going to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. You can also leave feedback for the show by going to faceoffshow.com/feedback. We love to hear from you guys. Go do that now. I'm asking you, go do that right now. Go to Face Off Show and give us some feedback or tweet us out or something. We love to hear from you guys. Thanks a lot, and we will see you next week.